Welcome everyone to our January series of seminars. We are delighted to welcome back Dr. Lou Mitchell, who will tell us all about C.S. Lewis. And I'm sure that he has things to share that we've probably not heard of before, because he has that kind of mind. So be prepared to enjoy these 4 weeks. And just a heads up, the last session on January 25th will be an hour earlier at 8:45. So, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back. I'm on, I take it. Can you hear me? Okay. Well, I'm going to open with prayer, because I'm going to do this. That's what we do. That's prayer. God, we thank you for the new year and new opportunities for growth. In many ways, we thank you for these seminars which have allowed the participants to not only learn but to be challenged about what it means to be a Christian living in the world you have made. As we learn a little bit more about this more contemporary figure, C.S. Lewis, we pray that we would find not only knowledge but maybe some wisdom and being able to put it into practical implementation. All this we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, New Year's is the time for us.
Mic check.
Am I not on?
I don't know.
I thought I was on. It's in my pocket, yeah. I'll talk with that. I wasn't on.
Your voice is big enough. We can't tell.
People have told me that, but they can hear my voice.
I think you're good.
Well, I'm here. All right, so this is what I have, and this is a prayer for New Year's Day, okay? New Year's Day. And don't bow your heads, but just listen. Prayer for New Year's Day. Dear Lord, so far this year, God, I've done all right. I haven't gossiped. I haven't lost my temper. Haven't been greedy, grumpy, nasty, selfish, or overindulgent. I'm really glad about that. But in a few minutes, God, I'm going to get out of bed. And from then on, I'm probably going to need a lot more help. Thank you, in Jesus' name, amen. I love that one. It's not really about New Year's Day. I conformed it to that. Okay, the last time I was here, we talked about someone you probably knew less about than C.S. Lewis, and that was Jonathan Edwards. Remember that? Well, that was great fun, because I hadn't had the opportunity to do a course with lay people on Edwards. But here's the thing. With Jonathan Edwards, I am something of maybe a second-class expert. I've spent many, many years studying Edwards. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Edwards. I published a book on Edwards and articles on Edwards. Now, we cannot say the same about C.S. Lewis. I do not pretend to be an expert on C.S. Lewis, but I have been much exposed to him and I have studied him. And I'm reminded of, and I'm going to use this example because we're going to see the very different approach to education in the British university system then, and in some ways I think it's still this way, although I'm not totally sure, and the American system. For example, in the doctoral program, this was at Harvard where I did mine. You do 2 years of residence and you do coursework in all of that. There are languages that have to be passed, exams. I had Latin, German, and French, and I can't do anything with those languages anymore. But just enough to get through this. And then before you're allowed to even begin to work on your dissertation topic, you have to pass what are called general exams. Now, general exams were in three fields, and there was a week of written exams, okay? A whole week of written exams, and then four professors read those exams, and then I had to have an oral exam with the four professors having done that. And if you survive that, then you can move on to the dissertation. In the British system, we're going to see, you don't do the general work. You start on your topic, and you're a specialist in that topic all throughout the thing. We're going to see that's what C.S. Lewis was. In the undergraduate system, there was no liberal arts kind of thing. He had a topic, and that's what he studied, and that's what he became an expert in, and that's the British system. At one point, I was thinking of going to one of the British schools, University of Edinburgh, but it was around the time that Margaret, help me out, guys. Thatcher raised the tuition for non-Britishers, so I stayed where I was. So here's the point I wanted to make, though, about C.S. Lewis. You may wonder, what is this guy talking about? One of the professors said to me that in our 2 hours together, we will come to the limit of your knowledge. Whether you pass or not depends on how quickly we get there. So my point is that somewhere along the line here, we're going to come to the limits of my knowledge of C.S. Lewis. And hopefully that'll be, it won't be too quickly. Maybe we'll get through 4 weeks without it being noticed. Now for me, like many, I was introduced to C.S. Lewis through the Narnia Chronicles. Is that true for others of you? Yeah, we read them to our kids at night. We read a chapter or so at night, and we worked our way through all seven books of the Narnia Chronicles. Then the movies came up by then. And then the other thing that I was exposed to was his work on Mere Christianity. Have any of you read that or read in that? Oh, good. Well, that's kind of a work of what we would call apologetics. And next week, we're going to look at that aspect of C.S. Lewis. We'll talk about Mere Christianity and some of his other works in defending and promoting the Christian faith. And out of that, what impressed me was what was called the Trilemma, Trilemma 3, where in Mere Christianity, Lewis says about Jesus, he's one of three things. He's either a liar, a lunatic, or he's the Lord, for someone to say the things that he said about himself. That is one that if anybody who's read Mere Christianity remembers, and some know that, but they don't even know where it came from. Then I read his autobiography, A Surprise by Joy, and I was so impressed that here was a man who lived in the academic world. And he paid a price in the academic world, we're going to see, for his popular writings. Surprised by Joy, his spiritual autobiography, and from then on, I was hooked. How many of you have read A Grief Observed? Yeah, you guys are pretty knowledgeable about Lewis, is that right? Anybody want to come up here instead of me and tell us about it? A brief biography of C.S. Lewis, Clive Staples Lewis. There's the C.S. Early in childhood, he said he wanted to be called Jaxie, so he ended up with the name Jack. So his friends and people who knew him called him Jack Lewis. He was born on November 29th, 1898, the end of the 19th century. He died, mark this date, November 22nd, 1963. What else happened on November 22nd, 1963?
Yeah,
John F. Kennedy was assassinated that day. So when Lewis died, all the news and everything was overwhelmed with him. He was Irish. Belfast was where he was born. an Ulster Protestant family. His father, Albert, was a solicitor. So they were, you know, they weren't poor, middle class. His mother, Florence, was a real treasure. He had a brother. He had a brother named Warren, who he called Warney. And for both of them, when they were young children, she made life beautiful for them. Encouraged a world of imagination, secure in her love. And then tragedy hit in 1908, when he was 10 years old, his mother died of cancer. The world changed for C.S. Lewis then. He never was able to have a good, what we would call a good relationship with his father. His father kind of went off the deep end in some ways. And one of the things he did, which was horrible, many would say, is he sent the boys away to boarding school. Here they lost their mother. Now they were losing their home. They were losing their father. And they were losing each other because they went, at the beginning, to two different schools. Lewis hated the boarding schools that he went to. He went to the first one called Wynyard, W-Y-N-Y-A-R-D. And this one was probably, you would say, it was incompetently managed. Lewis was picked on. There was a system almost like being in a fraternity, pledging, or in the military, colleges, universities, where, you know, if you're the low one on the totem pole, you serve everybody else. And you had to play games, physical, sporting games. Lewis hated playing games. He said he was a big lout of a boy, but very uncoordinated. Where Lewis lived from the time of his childhood with his brother Warren was in their minds. Very creative, creating a whole world, Boxham that called it. This is kind of, we see some of this, you know, stirring up what will later become Narnia. And how many of you, have you read the Space Trilogy, the three books about travel in space? You have? Okay, we're going to tell you about those two. Those aren't quite as well, they're not as well known, but they're also very good. Well, then he went to another school called Malvern, and his brother Warney had gone there before him. Now, Warney, while he was in school, took a cadet route to the military, and his whole career was spent in the military. Not so Lewis. But then, fortunately, Lewis was given the opportunity to go and study with someone that his brother had studied with just shortly before, a man by the name of William Kirkpatrick, known as the Great Knock, K-N-O-C-K, in Surrey. He was so impressed with Kirkpatrick that he modeled a character in the third of the Space Trilogy, That Hideous Strength, after him. Kirkpatrick was a no-nonsense, rational person. When Lewis was at the second school, Malvern, he identified himself as an atheist, even though he still had to go through the church scene to please his father. In fact, he talks about being confirmation, without believing anything of what he was supposed to believe. Well, Kirkpatrick was an atheist too, out of a very rational kind of thing. Like, he talks about first meeting him, and Kirkpatrick meets him at the train station, And Lewis just makes an off-the-cuff statement. Oh, I didn't think the foliage would be as wild as it is out here. And Kirkpatrick stopped him right in his tracks. Why would you possibly have an opinion, not having been here, about what the foliage was like? And that was the kind of dialectic that they had, the kind of interviewing that they had. Now, when I said about studying specialization, what Lewis studied with Kirkpatrick was Greek and Latin. And what he read were the classics, ancient classics of Greek and Latin. He says this. This is a quote from his spiritual autobiography. The greatest service we can do to education is to teach fewer subjects. No one has time to do more than a very few things well before he is 20. And when we force a boy to be a mediocrity in a dozen subjects, we destroy his standards, perhaps for life. And we're going to see that in his studies, as an undergraduate, this is what he focuses on. Greek, Latin, the classics, and I'll describe the system in a minute. But he got into an ideal schedule. He lived in the Kirkpatrick house. Mrs. Kirkpatrick was there and, you know, made the meals and everything. This is the kind of day he had. You know, he would be given a passage and a dictionary, and he would have to translate that passage. And Kirkpatrick would check him on. And that's how he learned to read those languages. Here's his ideal schedule, he said. Breakfast at 8 exactly. At my desk by 9 a.m., there to read or write until 1 p.m. At 1 p.m. precisely, lunch. By 2 p.m., out walking. And he didn't want to go walking and talking with anybody. He said those are two different activities. There's walking and there's talking. And when you're walking, you want your senses to be open to all of the world. I didn't tell my wife that until now. I wanted to do it in a safe environment. But walking and talking. Okay, so he goes out for a walk at 2, back for tea at 4:15. To work again between 5 and 7. I mean, he's doing a lot of studying. He's doing a lot of intensive studying. Then dinner, and then he would talk in the evening with Kirkpatrick, reviewing the work or just talking about anything. And his downfall of that system was having to write letters at night. See, this is only one. This is letters to one person that C.S. Lewis wrote, a man by the name of Arthur Greaves. The letters of C.S. Lewis are published. They're in three volumes, and volumes 2 and 3 are much thicker than this one. Again, this is a separate one to a lifelong friend, someone he knew as when they were children, and all throughout his life he carries on a correspondence. And it's very interesting. We'll see it's crucial at one point. Okay, so having been well trained by Kirkpatrick, he prepares to study at Oxford. Now, there were exams that had to be passed before you could matriculate, before you could get in. One of them was in math. He dreaded having to take math. See, you had to develop this, what we might call kind of liberal artsy education, before you're even admitted. Because once you're admitted, you're going to focus on your subject, and you're not going to have this broad educational thing. Well, so he went back and studied with Kirkpatrick for a little bit more, and he goes off, and I'm not sure if he failed or he didn't have to take that one yet, but at any rate, he enters Oxford in 1917. Now, what was going on? Yeah, World War I. So his studies are interrupted when he becomes a second lieutenant and is on the front lines of the war. In fact, Lewis is wounded in 1918. Shrapnel, he's wounded. And in a way, that did release him from having to be on the front lines. While in the service, he made a close friend by the name of Patty Moore, M-O-O-R-E. And they made a pledge to each other that if one of them died, that the other one would take care of, in Patty Moore's case, his mother, in Lewis's case, his father. And Patty Moore died, was killed on the lines. And so we have the strange case of Mrs. Moore. Her name was Jane Moore. She had a daughter named Maureen. Jack did care for her for the rest of her life. Now, if you read a biographer like A.N. Wilson, who is a little more kind of digging it in, there's speculation, did they have a sexual relationship? She was much older than him. Maybe. Whatever the connection was, Lewis supported her, took care of her and Maureen for the rest of her life. In fact, they moved in with him and Warney at one point in the Kilns, which was the house they bought in Oxford. And in fact, it was Maureen who ended up owning the house afterwards, although it's a tourist site now, as are some of the other sites of C.S. Lewis. Well, he returns to Oxford in 1919 and begins again this curriculum. And fortunately for him, because he was in the military, he was exempted from those exams, so he didn't have to do anything in math. So he skated by that one. Undergraduate education was in two parts in this field. Again, he's studying classical languages and literature. There was one called Classical Honor Moderation, or MODS. That was the first one that one studied. And that specialized in the languages, of knowing the languages. At the end of MODS, you would take an exam, and it would determine how you were placed and if you could go on to the next level, which was literary humaniores, literature, classical literature, classical philosophy. Lewis was schooled in. Well, this is still the undergraduate degree. In both of those, one could get a ranking. First was the highest ranking. Lewis got a first in MODS. He got a first in the literature one. That was pretty impressive. I mean, that's honors upon honors. He actually submitted an essay in a contest and won the essay and won some money for it as well. So he had what's called double firsts. And that's the kind of baccalaureate degree. The degree was in two. So he graduates with that. And he's encouraged to take some more schooling in what is becoming, we wouldn't think it is, but what was becoming kind of a new subject, in the British universities, and that was the field of English language and literature. You would think that that would have been all along, but no. For one, you know, it needed a whole repertoire, it needed a core of things of the study. And so he was encouraged to go back and study English language and literature, and he did what was very rarely done. He got a third first. I mean, this marked him out as practically being a genius. He had a triple first at Oxford. It may not seem such a big deal to us, but it was rarely done. His first teaching assignment came within Oxford. You know, Oxford has the college systems. One does a lot, most of their work within one particular college of the university. Yale has college system. Harvard does not. They have what's called houses, and that's more for just living and tutoring. So he is at one of the colleges, I forget, filling in for a regular faculty member is on sabbatical in the field of philosophy. Lewis is teaching philosophy. Why? Well, because he was schooled in ancient philosophy because of the study of ancient languages and literature. And then in 1924, he is elected a fellow and tutor in English at what is called, we would see it read Magdalen, like Mary Magdalene College at Oxford, but it's pronounced Magdalen. Just a British thing. The first time I heard that, no, he didn't teach at Magdalen, he taught at Magdalen. What are they talking about, these people? Well, it's one and the same. He tried his hand at poetry, you know, long lyric poetry, published under another name, you know, not his name, and it really didn't go anywhere. So at some point he kind of gave up on, he envisioned himself of being a poet. And that didn't work out. Lewis was a tutor. A tutor was different than a chaired professor. A chaired professor gave lectures and courses. A tutor would give lectures sometimes too and offer courses, but in the British system, they would work individually or in small groups with students. One, they were kind of like their guidance counselors, you know, helping them get through, but Lewis had rooms within the college. It's funny, there's a building in Magdalen called New College. They call it the New Building. It's from the 18th century, so that lets you know. So he had rooms there in which he could stay, and that's where he would give his tutoring. And the way the tutoring worked, and this is the way he was educated, you have a particular topic that you're working on, and weekly the students would come in with a paper that they had written. And they would read the paper to the group of students and the tutor, and then they would go from there. The tutor would critique and all of that. Well, it wasn't so bad kind of when he started right after the war, because there weren't really that many students. But as time went on and the student population grew, it became a kind of a burden. I mean, he had to work hard in this position as a tutor within Magdalen College. And he did that from 1925 to 1954. Most of his career was as a tutor. He later becomes, I guess we'll get to this. Well, we can get to it now. He later becomes a chaired professor at Cambridge. At Oxford, Lewis's popular writings made him unpopular with a number of the faculty. They thought, you know, a serious scholar should not be engaged in that kind of work. Now, here's something people may not quite know. Lewis was a serious scholar. He had an enormous output of writing in the scholarly fields, which apart from anything else would have established him as a major scholar. Let me tell you some of these things. One of the things he did was he wrote a book called The Allegory of Love. It was a study in medieval tradition about the concept of love in the Middle Ages. That's where he became focused on the Middle Ages and the Renaissance in terms of English literature. Do you want to see these? Do you want me to pass them around? Well, there's more to come. These are Experiment and Criticism, are lectures that he gave. What is this? In Cambridge. Pass those around. This one is Studies in Words. This is also lectures that he gave in Cambridge. And he gave some of these lectures where he was the guest, you know, at a prestigious, another university with a series of lectures. That's what, you know, scholars do. Let's see, what else do we have in our bag of trips? He wrote, this was a course he taught at Oxford, A Preface to Paradise Lost. That's that, those were lectures. He wrote an introduction. These are introductory lectures on medieval and Renaissance literature. I'll send it. Okay, you go ahead. And then the piece de resistance is he was asked to write a volume in English literature in the Oxford series of English literature, Oxford History of English Literature. He called it Oh Hell. Oxford History of English Literature. And he writes about the literature, English literature, in the 16th century, excluding drama, like not the Shakespeare and all that other stuff. And this is a major, major work. I'll just pass that around. That may be the one thing you might not quite have known about C.S. Lewis, that besides the enormous output of his writings, and by the way, he wrote by hand. He wrote everything out by hand. He published a lot of books on popular Christianity. And he had these three volumes of letters. He was constantly on the output, but the thing I want to note is that Lewis was a serious scholar and unfortunately was overlooked time and again when an opportunity would come up at Oxford. Till finally, Cambridge pretty much established a chair to get him. He's the one they wanted. He didn't want to leave Oxford. In fact, Oxford tried to rally, but he was already committed to Cambridge, and Cambridge allowed him to live in his rooms in the, you know what the Cambridge College was? Magdalen. Magdalen. That's the college, but with an E on the end it was spelled. So that he was at Magdalen College in Oxford, and he went to Cambridge, he went to Magdalen. Something about him and Mary Magdalene, I don't know. But at Cambridge, they spell with an E. He was allowed to live in his rooms because he did have rooms. And during the week, he would stay in Cambridge. And on the weekend, he would take the train back to Oxford, to the Kilns, to his brother, to Mrs. Moore and Maureen back at the Kilns. He was elected a fellow of the British Academy. He was later elected as a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. He gave several distinguished lecture series. He wrote other work. I mean, this is only some of his academic output. experiment in criticism, studies in words, a discarded image, on and on. One of the things that was helpful for him at Oxford was he was a jolly kind of guy. Good beer and conversation, you know, went a long way. Boy, did they drink back then. Before dinner in, you know, in the university, in the dining hall, you know, they'd have cocktails before, they'd have wine during dinner, they'd have port and cigars after dinner, and then sometimes they'd go out drinking after that. He was part of a group of literary folk that they named the Inklings. They named themselves Inklings, I-N-K, like ink, writers. They met at a pub once a week in Oxford. The pub was called the Eagle and Child, although it was known popularly as the Bird and Babe. And I've been there. I've been in the room where they met. Bartender took a picture of me hoisting one in their memory. And here were people, some of these names you might not know, Charles Williams, Owen Barfield, and J.R.R. Tolkien, who also taught at Oxford, became friends with C.S. Lewis, and was part of the group known as the Inklings. Later on, sometimes they met in Lewis's rooms in Magdalen College. And there'll be an important event that takes place there. It is C.S. Lewis who encourages J.R.R. Tolkien to get off his butt and publish the Lord of the Rings trilogy. See, they would read what they were working on to the group. So Tolkien would read from what he was writing. And it really was Lewis who really helped move him to be able to finish the Lord of the Rings and then to publish the Lord of the Rings. Tolkien was a philologist, a study of words and meaning, ancient literature. That's why he invented the language of the elves. I mean, he really did invent a consistent language. Tolkien, however, was not much pleased with Narnia. He thought it was too simplistic. He thought the symbolism was a little too obvious. So he didn't really encourage Lewis on the publication of Narnia, but other things were read. Now, how much time do we have? How much time do I have? When do we stop?
About 15 minutes.
Okay, good. There is a concept that Lewis writes about, experienced throughout his life. It started, the first remembrance of it he has is when he was a young child, his brother Warney presented him with a biscuit tin, biscuits or cookies, you know, which he had made a garden in, artificial garden in the tin. And Lewis, two things here, remembers the feeling he had in experiencing that. But then, this is not an easy thing kind of to grasp, so we're going to come at this in a couple of ways. But then the feeling, he calls the feeling joy. You could call it beauty. He calls it romanticism at one point, but his primary thing, he calls it joy. That's the name he gives it. It was when he later remembered the garden. You follow that? It was the memory of that experience and how he felt at that time that he labeled joy. Stay with me, we're not done yet. The second instance he remembers was reading Beatrix Potter's Squirrel Nutkin and being impressed with the idea of autumn. I haven't read that work, so I don't know what it is. But the concept of autumn produced in him this, we would also call it a longing, that he labeled joy. Thirdly, something that might not affect us so much, Lewis was really moved by Norse poetry. Northernness, the coldness, Wagner's operas of the Ring trilogy. The phrase from a poem, "I heard a voice that cried, Balder the beautiful is dead," that moved him. Somehow, Balder was one of the gods of this. Now again, we might not relate to this, but I'll bet you in our lives, if once we understand what he's talking about, we'll be able to say, yeah, that's happened to me too. The common quality in all three of these, he says, is this. My book fell and broke, so let me see how I get this now. Page 209. This is his spiritual autobiography called Surprised by Joy. See, there's that encounter. He says this, if I get to it. Surprised by joy, common quality, and oh, no, sorry. It's from another work. It's from a work, Pilgrim's Progress. He says this. What I meant by this, he calls it romanticism here, when I wrote this work, was a particular recurrent experience which dominated my childhood and adolescence, and which I called romantic because inanimate nature and marvelous literature were among the things that evoked it. Now here he gets to kind of the heart of the definition of an experience for him. The experience is one of intense longing, distinguished from other longings by two ideas. One, though the sense of want, wanting what is desired, is acute and maybe even painful, yet the mere wanting is felt to be somehow a delight. The experience of the longing and wanting something, even without getting it, the experience of the longing is a delight. You follow that? Because that's important. Okay. The hunger is better than any fullness. This poverty better than all the wealth. And this it come and thus it comes about that if the desire is long absent, it may itself be desired. You might have the feeling of desire about the feeling of desire. Am I losing you guys? Well, it's his fault. Some of this will become a little clearer before we're done. And that the new desire becomes a new instance of the original desire. Okay, that's one distinguished. Secondly, it appeared to me that if a man diligently followed this desire, pursuing the false objects until their falsity appeared and then resolutely abandoning them, he must come out at least into the clear knowledge that the human soul was made to enjoy some delight that is never fully given. He's saying that it's a characteristic of being human that we have an intense desire that nothing in this world can fulfill. Many you can't even imagine it as given in our present mode of subjective and spatio-temporal experience. I think here he's talking about what St. Augustine identified in his Confessions, and it's, do I need to stay still? And it's one of the most significant kind of little blurbs in Western literature. I could give it to you in Latin, but that would just be meaningless impression. Augustine says this of God. You probably know this one. Thou hast made us for thine own. Does this sound familiar? And our heart, our plural heart singular, that if I said in Latin, that would be it. Our heart is restless until it rests in thee. You have made us for yourself, God, and our heart is restless until it rests in you. I think that's what Lewis is talking about. That there is something within us that for Lewis stirred deep feelings that nothing in this world can satisfy, ultimately. We get a glimpse of it. It's like what he says in a sermon that he gave called The Weight of Glory. He says this. He says, we have been mere spectators. Beauty has smiled, but not to welcome us. Her face was turned in our direction, but not to see us. We have not been accepted, welcome, and taken into the dance. We do not merely want to see beauty, though God knows even that is beauty enough. We want something else, which can hardly be put into words, to be united with the beauty we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become part of it. But what mostly happens is we get a sense of it and then it's gone. I am a musician, and early in my life, music was my life. I majored in music. And so I played and performed in ensembles and bands and all of that. And I can remember that feeling of a particular piece of music that was so beautiful. It made your heart hurt. But then you listen to it the week after, it's nice, but the beauty has passed on. Have you had any experiences like that? You get you're shaking head. Is this just completely wacko for some folks? That's what Lewis is trying to get at. There is, and he called it joy. And he tried and tried to explain it. He experienced it. And then it was gone. And it was the longing for the experience of longing for something that he also wanted. That's what he meant by that one confusing phrase, yeah.
Did this all happen, you know, starting as a very practical person in his teaching and his learning? It seems like such a transition that he went from the classics and then developed this sense of belonging. Is that before he becomes a Christian?
He started the sense of longing as a child. The tin garden, and then remembering how he felt about the garden, reading Beatrix Potter.
So when he's writing this now, he's not a Christian?
No, he's not a Christian. Well, what I read, the sermon I read from, yeah, about, you know, beauty is not, it smiled on us, but he was a Christian then. Because... let me see how much time I have. I'm not going to get through his conversions. And I do want to take the time to do it. So just give me 1 minute. Let me see where I am. No, if I introduce something, it's going to open up a whole different way of going. I will say this. I'll get us there before he gets us there. How's that? Okay. What Lewis discovers, and once he becomes a Christian, joy is no longer all that important to him, because he realizes what the function of it was. The function of joy and the longing was, he says, a signpost to seek God, because he learned that nothing in this world, literature, music, friendship, fulfilled that longing, and that the longing was ultimately a longing for God. You have made us for yourself, Augustine said. And our heart collectively, singular heart, our, the plural, our heart is restless. How we long for something until it rests in you. Oh, here's the Latin. Facisti nos ad te, et in quae etiam est cor nostrum donec, resquiescat in te. Okay, rather than getting into new content, reaction, questions.
So the loss of his mother.
Say that again?
The loss of his mother at his young age.
Oh, it was horrible,
yeah,
for him.
But, I mean, that's kind of dumb, simplistic way. But had he not lost her, would his life change?
Well, we don't know. We don't know what it would have been.
Could you repeat the question for the folks online?
The question was, the loss of his mother, did it, you think, contributed to that? Yeah. And what would it have been like if he hadn't lost his mother? There's just no way. But they both loved her, and she made life joyous for them. That could very well be part of the seeking the lost love of a mother, too. Some wonder if Mrs. Moore didn't take that role for him. I think, are we done?
You still have a couple of minutes.
Okay, questions, comments, more?
Got the mic.
I mean, have I communicated it enough that you get a sense of what he's trying to get at and can't really get at? Good. Well, I'm done, so. Thanks. Next week, we're going to start with his, what I call conversions. There's more than one. And then we'll get into his defense of the Christian faith. That's next week. Okay? See you then.